walk across the courtyard towards the library.
Hello and welcome to Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the Kodiak Public Library Association. Hi, I'm Lori. I'm on the board of KPLA. In tonight's show, we have several local personalities who you might recognize. We're going to start out with a review about our recent book sale. We're going to interview two new board members, Pat Szabo and Jeannie Ledoux. Jan Chatto has a book review for you. Matt Freeman has created a profile on author Lee Child's Jack Reacher series in our Community Roars. We also have a Beyond the Cover segment this evening where James Raines interviews Jessica Shattuck. We have news about what's happening this summer at the Kodiak Public Library from Katie Baxter, director of the Kodiak Public Library, as well as another author highlight on Louise Erdrich. And we'll replay a book review about The Princess Bride from Nia and Katie. During the month of May, we've had a lot of activity at the Kodiak Public Library Association. Most notably, one of our most successful book sales happened during Crabfest weekend. I want to thank everybody who came out and supported the Library Association and bought books. There were some great finds out there. We've also had the pleasure of adding some new board members. We now have a 9-member board, and I'd like to welcome Jeannie Ledoux. Jeannie has called Kodiak her home for 40 years, raising her children and teaching in the school district. Recently retired from teaching elementary music, she now enjoys her 8 grandchildren and reading. Welcome, Jeannie. Happy to have you with us today. And I want to ask you to tell us a little bit about your interests and about yourself.
Well, I like to read. I like to do sewing and knitting, but reading is probably my favorite.
What drew you to the KPLA board?
I've always wanted to volunteer with something and go where there's a need, and there was a need, so here I am.
Well, we're very happy to have you. You told a story in our recent newsletter about where your love of reading came from. Where did you find that interest?
Well, my grandmother was very instrumental in my life, and she had many books, of which she shared with me, and she always had books about Alaska, which happens to be my favorite reading subject.
Well, that's really special. Do you have any favorite resources at the Kodiak Public Library that draw you in?
I like the books. Something you can hold in your hand, something I'm used to reading, not on a screen, but in my hand.
Do you have a lot of books at home?
A lot of books.
Have you read them all?
No.
How many books are on your table at one time that you're working on?
Well, I think I've pared it down to 4, but there might be a couple downstairs too.
Well, what would you tell a visitor is your favorite part of our new library? If somebody was to come to Kodiak, what would you tell them that is special about our new library?
The children's section. It's beautiful for all ages. When the children come in there, you can just see the light in their eyes.
And the joy of reading. Mm-hmm. As a member of the new KPLA board, we have some activities coming up that are new and different, and we're hoping to make a difference. Is there anything that you would like to get involved in?
Well, when we did the book fair during Crab Fest, the book sales, that was pretty fun. Mm-hmm. A lot of people got a lot of books and had a good time, and I guess it's something I'm used to, is a little bit of fundraising is comfortable.
That's good. Well, we're very happy to have you on the board, and your experience with music and with children will be an asset to us. We're thankful.
Thank you, Lori. I appreciate that.
Yes. Well, thank you, Jeannie, for coming in today. Another new member of our board is Pat Szabo. She's lived in Kodiak since 1971. Pat has enjoyed community involvement and over the years served on a number of boards as well as acted and directed in community theater. Welcome, Pat.
Hi, Lori.
Hi. I'm glad to have you with me today. Tell us a little bit about your interests.
My interest in the community, I have been on a number of boards long time ago, the KMXT and the Arts Council and Planning and Zoning and the School Board. Now I find that I'm most interested in community theater, and I've acted and directed, and it's so much fun to perform for an audience.
And we enjoy that too. That's wonderful. What drew you to be involved with the Kodiak Public Library Association board?
Well, I think probably it started with coming to the new library and what a beautiful space it is.
Yes, it is.
And then I started to volunteer and realized all the great activities that were going on in the library, and I wanted to be part of it. And I heard that there might be an opening on the board, so I applied.
What activities do you hope to get involved with in the Kodiak Public Library Association?
Well, in meetings, we've talked about little free libraries. And as I understand it, these are small sources of books around the community. I think that sounds very exciting as a way to get books out to people in an easy way for them to access them.
Yes, we're looking into doing that, and we hope to have some carpenters build some little bookcases in people's yards, and we're just starting that project, so we're glad that you're interested in it and glad to be on board. Do you have a favorite resource at the Kodiak Public Library that you like to take advantage of?
I'm a reader. I have always been a reader. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the books. I volunteer a couple of hours each week, and what I do is reshelve books that people have taken out and then returned. And I have found the most wonderful books that I might otherwise not have known were there. So they're just a fascinating collection. And then, of course, the library has a great collection of DVDs.
If a visitor came into the library, what resource would you share with them, or what do you think is an outstanding resource?
Well, I had a great time. I think it was the first cruise ship. The library invites passengers to come up and use free Wi-Fi. And these people have not seen Wi-Fi for weeks, I think, because they were on a long cruise. They came by the tens and hundreds. I got to welcome them and show them around the library. And I think the thing that all of us enjoyed the most was all the wonderful artwork in the library. And they were fascinated by Alaskan artists and Kodiak artists.
Yes, we have quite a beautiful variety there. And so you tour the library and share the artwork that's
yes,
up there.
There's even a pamphlet at the desk for anybody who would like to look at all the artwork that takes you through the library. It shows the artwork, who the artist is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating. I'll bet some of our local people haven't taken that tour.
Could be.
Yes. How often are you up there doing that?
A number of different volunteers do the cruise ships, but the cruise ships come every other Wednesday.
Oh, that's right. But you also volunteer at the library shelving books and things?
Yes, and shelving books, and periodically the library accesses books that have been around a long time or that haven't been checked out or that have in some way become no longer a key part of the collection. And I help with that under the guidance, of course, of the staff. And actually, these are the books that then at our Crab Festival book sale are available to the public at very reasonable rates.
Very reasonable rates. And we had an outstanding sale, in part, I believe, because of all of these books that had been, well, we say discarded, but reused would might be a better term.
Well, we even had one customer who found a book that she had been trying to find and hadn't been able to find it on the internet. What she said it was like worth $150, and I think at the library she probably got it for $1.50, and she was so delighted.
Well, that's great. Well, we do have, just for the public's information, we also have books for sale all the time in the book bins, and you can find some treasures there as well. Well, Pat, we're very happy to have your energy and your insight on our board, and we look forward to having a great time working with you in the next 3 years while you're on the KPLA board.
Well, I'm looking forward to being part of such a dynamic place.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming in today. In our community roar, or raving over amazing reads, Jan Chatto reviews a book about surfing. Give a listen.
My name's Jan Chatto, and many of you know me. I love books. And I was doing something the other day, which many of you have done. I'm just surfing the web looking for a new book to either buy or get from my library. And I saw a book called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan. And my husband was an avid surfer, so I thought, well, maybe this will be interesting. And then I noticed it won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for autobiography, which surprised me because often surf articles are more like, hey, dude, the wave was rad, and that's about all you get. But with this book, there was a lot more. The Pulitzer Prize Board said that it was an old school adventure story and intellectual autobiography, a social history, a literary road movie, and an extraordinary exploration of the gradual mastering of an exacting, little understood art, which I thought said a lot. So it's the story of Bill Finnegan's life, but it's also a study in why we can become obsessed with something in our lives, which in this case was surfing. I could relate to this tale because my own husband had been bitten by the surfing bug when he was a young boy also. I was witness to his endless fascination with surfing and wanted to understand it a bit more. However, this book is far more than just a book about surfing. Finnegan is a brilliant writer and reporter who has written for The New Yorker and Outside magazines. I particularly enjoyed the characters he so vividly recalls. Let's face it, extreme sports attract eccentric people, and he brings them to life. Fishermen can probably relate to Finnegan's endless fascination with the ocean and the weather. However, the details of the sport do not drag the reader into a rabbit warren of details. They seem essential to the tale. They remind me of the technical details found in Daniel Brown's Boys in the Boat, the true story of a rowing team. I enjoyed that book also, even though there were a lot of details about rowing and building boats. This memoir is a coming-of-age memoir to begin with. He was a Haole boy suddenly transplanted to Hawaii. And for any of you who don't know, Haole means little white kid. So he was definitely the outsider. He says, matters weren't helped by the fact that to my classmates, I seemed not to exist socially. I'm sure some of us can relate to that. I was the new kid in a high school myself. For my husband, it was a disfiguring accident that sent him into social limbo. The surfing crowd didn't care what his face looked like. The love of the sport and the ocean was their bond. This book dives deeply into the inner motivation for our passions. Finnegan says memoir is a weird genre for a reporter. You end up investigating your own private life to be super self-centered, which is the opposite of reporting. He kept journals in his youth, which were helpful, although he says they were not so much full of facts as they were obtuse and abstract. The impetus to begin the book, which had been floating around in his head for years, came from letters that he had written to a friend some 40 years ago, which were returned to him by that friend's mother. I wonder if any of us will have words of our youth preserved like that. In an interview, he states, I try to ease people into the water, keep them oriented, introduce the terms of the art without dumbing things down. Give readers a stake in every surf scene, not necessarily through action, but through characters. Core surfers rightly snort at every crossover effort to depict their world. Credibility and authenticity just seem to vanish. We can all recall the Gidget movies. This book brings that world vividly to life. I traveled all over the world with Finnegan and his weird buddies as he sought the perfect wave. One of the conflicts of the book is how do you continue a passion like this and still be the grown-up with a family and the big boy job? Should you continue your passion or should you just let it go? And that conflict plays through the book as he tries to decide and then jumps for that next wave. I found the book fascinating and a really good read, so I would recommend it to anybody, even if you're not a particular surfing fan. The name of the book again is Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan.
Thank you, Jan. That sounds like a really good summer read. Community Roars Over Reading has a second segment this evening, Matt Freeman. He tells us about the Jack Reacher series written by Lee Childs, perfect for summer reading.
Hi, I'm Matt Freeman for Dog-Eared Reads, and I'm here to tell you about the Jack Reacher series by Lee Child. The first thing you need to know is that the Jack Reacher of the books looks nothing like Tom Cruise. Nothing. Okay, Tom Cruise is a short dude about 5'7", and he looks like a movie star. Now, Jack Reacher, from the book series, is 6'5", weighs somewhere between 210 to 250 pounds, and looks like somebody started to sculpt a figure out of rock and then ran out of time. Casting Tom Cruise as Jack Reacher, it's an affront to plain, tall men everywhere. I would say that the Jack Reacher series is essentially a Western transplanted to modern day. Jack Reacher's like the Lone Ranger without a horse, or Tonto. He's like the Clint Eastwood guy, the man with no name. Although in Reacher's case, he's more like the man with no address, because one of the quirky things about Jack Reacher is that he just wanders around the country. Florida, New York City, the Midwest, some little tiny town in the middle of nowhere, it doesn't matter. He just likes to keep moving. He doesn't really have stuff. He doesn't have anything to really tie him down. He's got no phone, no home, no motor car, not a single luxury. He's just out there. And he's not really looking for trouble, but it does seem to find him regularly. Here's a day in the life of Jack Reacher. He wakes up in some cheap but clean hotel, then finds breakfast at a nearby diner, buys a new shirt and socks and underwear from a nearby store, changes out, throws his old clothes away. It's just a thing he does. And then he'll hit the road, maybe go hitchhiking. That can lead to exciting and deadly trouble. Here's a perfect example from 2012's Jack Reacher novel, A Wanted Man. Here's the jacket blurb. Four people in a car, hoping to make Chicago by morning. One man driving, eyes on the road. Another man next to him, telling stories that don't add up. A woman in the back, silent and worried. And next to her, a huge man with a broken nose, hitching a ride east to Virginia. An hour behind them, a man lies stabbed to death in an old pumping station. He was seen going in with two others, but he never came out. He has been executed. The knife work, professional. The killers vanished. Within minutes, the police are notified. Within hours, the FBI descends, laying claim to the victim without ever saying who he was or why he was there. All Reacher wanted was a ride to Virginia. All he did was stick out his thumb. But he soon discovers that he has hitched more than a ride. He has tied himself to a massive conspiracy that makes him a threat to both sides at once. In Lee Child's white-hot thriller, nothing is what it seems, and nobody is telling the truth. As the tension rises, the twists come fast and furious, keeping readers guessing and gasping until the explosive finale. That is a very typical Jack Reacher plot. You've got innocent victims, homicidal bad guys, buried secrets, and unburied dead bodies lying around. Jack Reacher has two loves. One, good, strong coffee, and the other one, good-looking women in uniform. I would describe Jack Reacher's relationships as more of a catch-and-release program, but if he comes across a woman who is in the military or law enforcement, who's reasonably good-looking, very smart, very good at her job, very efficient, then you can bet that sparks will fly. None of them are quite exactly enough to get him to settle down and get a house. In fact, in one episode, he even is given a house. He inherits a house, a very nice house. And right at that same time, there's a woman who does get under his skin a little more than anyone else has. And he does get tempted to just give up the wandering life and be what he's never been. A guy with a living room and stuff. But he somehow overcomes that, and the series continues. One of the creepiest mysteries that Jack Reacher has to solve is a case that involves a series of suicides, women in the military who were all victims of sexual harassment and who all apparently kill themselves in the same way. They're found in bathtubs filled with buckets and buckets of Army regulation camouflage paint, dead, without a mark on them, except for the paint. So the puzzle here is, who is really wanting all these women dead, and how is he doing it? How is he convincing them to get in that tub and to die? It's really bizarre. The creepiest one of all, though, I'd have to say, is the 2015 novel Make Me, in which Reacher discovers that there's a cheap hotel in this tiny town called Mother's Rest, a motel in which people from out of town check in, but they don't always check out. So as Reacher tries to figure out if it's more like the Hotel California or maybe just a roach motel, he finds a horrific answer to where these people go and what happens to them. I can say no more. I do recommend that you get out there, check these books out from the Kodiak Public Library, order them online, read them right away before Tom Cruise makes a movie out of them. All you gotta do is search for author Lee Child, C-H-I-L-D. Don't confuse him with Lincoln Child, that's a completely different author. If you find these books at all entertaining, then I think you'll be glad to know that there are 21 books out, plus a new series just coming out of short stories regarding Jack Reacher. Jack Reacher, a guy who just likes to wander around taking it easy and occasionally destroy counterfeiters, kidnappers, terrorists, human traffickers, assassins, serial killers, wife beaters, businessmen with dirty secrets, and other people that are so bad they don't really have a name for it.
And that was our Community Roars Over Reading segment of Dog-Eared Reads. Listen later on and you'll hear about one of my favorite authors, Louise Erdrich. A little bit of an extension this month on what we love to read.
On our Beyond the Cover segment this month, James Raines interviews Jessica Shattuck. She is the author of three notable works of fiction. Her debut book, The Hazards of Good Breeding, was a New York Times notable book, a Boston Globe Best Book of the Year, and a finalist for the 2003 Penn Winship Award. In 2009, she released her second novel, A Perfect Life, and in 2017 followed with her ambitious historical World War II fiction novel, The Woman in the Castle. It depicts the story of the widows of three conspirators involved in the assassination attempt on Hitler. This novel has received much acclaim, including being named an Amazon Best Book for April 2017. Jessica has also written nonfiction that has appeared in the New York Times, Mother Jones, Wired, The Believer magazine, The New Yorker, and others. Notable is her article in the New York Times in March 2017 discussing the reconciliation of her love for her grandmother with the knowledge that she was a Nazi. The Woman in the Castle is available in print or as a digital book at the Kodiak Public Library. Jessica lives in Brookline, Massachusetts with her husband and three children. Here's James interviewing Jessica Shattuck.
Let's just get started a little bit about yourself and your background. Where did you grow up? What were some of your favorite things to learn about?
So I grew up in three main places. I lived in New York City until I was five, and then I lived in Washington, D.C., and then my family moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts when I was 12. So I never know quite how to answer that question, but basically Eastern Seaboard, I guess. And what are my favorite things to learn about? I love learning about different times and places and sort of weird, unexplored corners of history or interesting specific facts around something I'm reading about. I think I'm generally a pretty curious person, so if I hear a good story, I usually want to know more.
Okay. When you were young, what were some of the writers that inspired you?
I loved Laura Ingalls Wilder. I was totally devoted to the Little House on the Prairie series, and I never saw the TV shows. I actually grew up in a house that didn't really have, I think we had like one little black and white TV in the basement that no one ever really watched. So my experience of those books is fully defined by her writing and by the books themselves, which I reread many times. I also really loved almost any books about King Arthur. So the one that really got me into that was, I think, in about sixth or seventh grade, I read Marion Zimmer Bradley's The Mists of Avalon and loved it, and then went on to read the Mary Stuart books, and I was really compelled by that story.
Right, excellent. So which authors or writers inspire you today?
Some of my favorites are E.M. Forster, Joseph Conrad. I love Dickens. I love plot in books, and I love the way Dickens works in so many intricate plots. I think we can all learn so much from him. As far as contemporary writers, I love Jennifer Egan's writing. I'm a big fan of Zadie Smith. Those are kind of, I'd say, the top ones that come to mind.
when did you decide, maybe in your childhood or early adulthood, when did you decide to become a writer?
I mean, I always loved writing. It was something that I did from elementary school on. I wrote a lot of poems in elementary school, and I remember in fourth grade winning a poetry contest. There was a subway that was put in my neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and somehow the city had sponsored this poetry contest. Kids had to write a poem about the subway, and I felt so proud and excited when my poem won, and I think that really affirmed for me that I had this part of my personality that was being a writer. And so it really was something I did a lot. I would just jot down poems in a little poem journal. And then as I got older, I started writing short stories. And so it's really was always something that I loved and always something that I felt like I could do.
Okay. Where do you think your ideas come from?
Everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say sometimes they come from things I'm reading, something I'll see in the paper. Sometimes they'll come from something someone, you know, I'll be having a conversation with someone and they'll tell me an interesting story, and that will later on come up in my mind as a seed of an idea for something. So I feel like my mind is always kind of finding things to fasten onto that will lead to other creative works.
Okay. So what books are you best known for?
Well, my current book right now is on the New York Times bestseller list, which is very exciting for me. And that's called The Women in the Castle. And so I guess I'd say that one is getting the widest readership. But I also was very lucky in the publication of my debut novel, The Hazards of Good Breeding, which was very well reviewed and seemed to get out there into the world. Very, very different from The Women in the Castle because it's a contemporary story. The Hazards of Good Breeding was a New York Times notable book, and it was a finalist for the Penn Winship Award. And then my book, Perfect Life, which was sort of my middle child of my books, is probably the least well-known. They're all fiction, and they're all literary fiction. They're novels. They're very different from each other in terms of the subject matter and setting. It's how I kind of make sense of the world, and it just is what I'm compelled to write.
Okay. Let's talk just for a minute on The Woman in the Castle. Could you explain a little bit of maybe a synopsis of that book and kind of what inspired you to write it?
Yeah, it's a book about three German widows living in an abandoned castle at the end of World War II. It begins in June 1945 as the war is just over. And they're all the wives of resistors. Their husbands were executed for varying roles in the failed assassination attempt on Hitler's life. It's known as the 20th of July assassination attempt. It was in 1944. As the story unfolds, you realize that while they share that, they actually, their stories are very different than they might at first appear to be, and these three women are very different from each other and have experienced and lived very different versions of the war and of their connection to Nazism and to Hitler. So they sort of span the gamut of the German political experience. So it's very much a book about the German experience of that time and about ordinary Germans, quote unquote, because none of the characters were truly heroes and none of them are truly victims. They're not villains. None of them are the sort of darkest figures that we can think of, the concentration camp guards or sadistic SS people. They're all kind of going through ordinary lives, mothers with children, and making small decisions or not making decisions sometimes that will come back and haunt them when the war is over and when the reality of what they've just been a part of comes clear.
Sounds like a very well-researched novel. Do you write full-time or part-time?
I write full-time, but I'm also a mother with three children, so full-time means their school music concerts and doing all the things that mothers have to do around the edges, or whoever there is, you know, caregivers have to do around the edges. But I try to work. I'm very disciplined about my work, and I do try to make sure that I'm writing every day and really try to make sure that I've got 4 solid hours of writing every day, preferably more, and certainly at times in writing my book, like, for instance, I'd say the last 3 months of writing The Women in the Castle, I was putting in much longer days, and I had a babysitter who was helping out more around the edges, and I was on deadline when I was putting in edits. So it can go up to like 8 hours a day. What I do is I basically, if my kids are home, I go to the public library around the corner from my house. When I'm in the home by myself, I have a little office that I can use, although actually that's kind of new. This book, I didn't really even have a home office while I was writing Women in the Castle. I had a desk in my bedroom, and I would write there, or I would go to the library and try as best I could to tune out the noise of email and all the other demands of life and focus in on my book.
Do you normally work from like an outline, or do you just kind of prefer to see where an idea takes you?
A little bit of both. I definitely don't start out with an outline. I begin with an idea that is exciting to me, and I start going with it. And usually the first 50 to 100 pages of a book seem to come fairly quickly to me. They don't always end up being the first 50 to 100 pages of the book, but sort of that initial process. And then my process becomes kind of stopping, taking stock, reading over, figuring out where is this all going, what am I picturing, cutting, you know, taking parts out, adding new things. And at that point, I'll sometimes outline what I already have and kind of make notes of what I need and what should go out. So it's, I can't say it's the most efficient process, but it's kind of a burst of writing and then a lot of editing and some outlining and more writing, more, you know, it's a lot of back and forth.
How do you think you've evolved creatively from your first book, The Hazards of Good Breeding, to your last book, The Woman in the Castle?
Well, it was such a different endeavor writing The Women in the Castle because it's a historical novel, so it involved so much research and it involved putting myself in a totally different place in time. I think I was probably better prepared to do that after having written the two books that came before because those were both contemporary and allowed me to work on the issues of plot and structure and pacing without the added level of also having to figure out how to fully inhabit another time and place. So I feel like those kind of prepared me for the task of writing The Women in the Castle, which was much more ambitious as an undertaking. I think that's been the process.
What do you think, for you personally, is the hardest thing about writing?
That's a good question. I mean, the hardest thing, I guess, is sitting there and making yourself write through the times that you're blocked or that you're kind of stuck on something. As somebody who likes to write plotted novels, I definitely hit places where I think, how exactly is this going to come together and how do I push? It's usually around plot questions that I will hit a wall and I'll really kind of have to do a lot of thinking, and it feels like days can go by, weeks can go by where I'm kind of stuck in some place. What often I end up doing is taking a long walk to kind of get my thoughts going in a different direction. Then I'll sometimes try something and write a whole chapter or more and then realize, no, that actually isn't the right direction. That's not how I'm going to solve this problem. Then certainly a hard part is getting rid of that chapter, because once you've written it, you don't really want to throw it away. So I'd say it's the persistence of getting through the hard parts when you feel stuck.
Okay. Just to talk about a little bit about research, it sounds like you've done a lot of research for The Woman in the Castle. Could you explain that process?
Yeah, I did a lot of research, but since this was a subject that I was always interested in, I'm half German, and I grew up hearing my mother's childhood stories about living in post-war Germany. So I had this background of family stories about that time. I also spent a summer when I was in college interviewing my grandmother about what it was like after the war, which then led to what it was like during the war, what she and my grandfather were doing during the war. So I kind of had this reservoir of family material to work with, and I, for years, was just interested in supplementing that for my own personal reasons, wanting to understand better a lot of the questions I had about it. So I had been doing research, not specifically for writing this book, but just because I was interested in the subject for a long time before I started writing this. And then once I decided I was ready to actually write this book, there was even more research to do. It took me almost 7 years to complete this book, and there was a lot of stopping and starting. I would start writing something and then I'd realize, I know a lot about World War II Germany, but now I need to go back and research what it was like to be in the Ruhrgebiet in the 1920s when it was occupied by the French, something that I hadn't read anything about before. So then I would stop writing and go research a lot and read on that, then I'd write more. So it was really like a lot of background research that I had just done kind of organically, and then once I started writing, it was a lot of stopping and doing supplemental research. And I have to say the internet was an amazing boon in terms of, obviously you have to read a lot of books for context and to make sure you're getting credible sources, but if I wanted something like an example of Hitler Youth uniform that a girl would have been wearing age 14, you know, in 1938 or something, it was three clicks away from looking at one depicted there that's for sale or something. So that was kind of an amazing thing that I discovered in writing this, and it made me also appreciate all the writing that people did, historical writing people did before the internet.
That makes sense. It seems like it would be very challenging.
Yeah.
Historical fiction, you have
to be accurate. There's a lot of self fact checking.
You said it took 7 years. During that time, did you ever get discouraged as you were writing this book? I mean, did you get to a point where you felt like you would never complete or...
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there were several times where I sort of thought, oh, it was interesting. It's actually, I feel like I was the most stressed out about how long it was taking when I was at about 2.5 or 3 years and I realized it was going to be a lot longer, because that was sort of, my previous two books had each taken about 2 years and it sort of felt like, okay, it should be wrapping up now. Once I was at like year five, it was like, well, this is just what I'm doing. I'm kind of used to this long process. But definitely there were points throughout where I would, like what I was describing earlier, when I would hit a wall and feel like, how am I going to solve this problem? I really need, you know, whatever it was, something in the structure, one of the characters or something that I would really be batting my head against, and I would think, is this, am I going to be able to bring it all together? So I think that's part of the process. I think every writer that I've talked to anyway goes through that at some point, and you have to look at it as every time you hit some place like that, it's like a problem to solve and there is a solution. You just have to be patient and keep working through different ways. And then other times I would feel like, wow, this is great. I'm so excited about this. So it was a real roller coaster.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, it's kind of off track here, but I have one more question in reference to that. At this time when you were writing this out, did you feel pulled in different directions by life, saying, you know, for example, you know, family matters or occupational things that were just trying to pull you away from consistently working on the novel?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure. I had my third child in the middle of it, which is probably some chunk of those 7 years. I think one thing that I've learned as I've gotten older is that taking the time, for instance, when I had my son, I think I was 2-3 years into this, I realized that I needed to just take the time to be with my baby and not force myself to try to multitask for the first 3 or 4 months. And I really took that time and I did not look at the book, and I looked at it as, this is an opportunity for me to put this aside and come to this material with fresh eyes at a different point. And that was great. At other times in my life, for instance, when my first child was born, I didn't give myself a lot of time to take off from what I was doing then. And I really pressured myself to keep up with my writing, even when I had a 6-week-old, a 4-week-old. And I think that that wasn't helpful, actually, at all. It just created kind of stress and a feeling of not getting anything done right. So certainly there was a push and pull at different times. But I think kind of being open to that push and pull and going with it, rather than forcing things all the time, was my solution.
And now look, it's on the New York Times bestseller list. So
yeah,
all that 7 years of work and pulls in different directions have all panned out. So where can we find more information out about you and your books?
Well, my website, which is just jessicashattuck.com, and my publisher has a website, which is thewomeninthecastle.com, are both good places to start.
Okay.
And then Amazon, all of those have the book.
All right, Jessica, thank you very much for taking the time to meet and to do this interview for us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, James Rains, for interviewing Jessica Shattuck this month for our Beyond the Cover.
Walk across the courtyard towards the library.
Now we'll hear from Katie Baxter, Kodiak Public Library Director, who will inform us about the activities happening at the Kodiak Public Library this summer. Build a Better World is the theme for the summer reading program.
This is Katie from Kodiak Public Library. Thanks to library staff, the National Collaborative Summer Library Program, Alaska State Library, the City of Kodiak, and numerous of local sponsors, you, your friends, and your family can keep up with reading, playing your favorite board games, and enjoying activities at the public library throughout June and July. The summer theme is Build a Better World and stretches across science, math, and art activities, gardening and recycling, building and repurposing. Kids have a chance to build scribble bots. Adults can go on a special field trip to the Aleutic Museum. Lego masters can participate in a builder's afternoon. The Graphic Novel Book Club continues at the Kodiak Island Brewery, and the Blockbusters Book Club gets underway at the library. You can come in from your campsite and get a pile of books or a board game to enjoy in the great outdoors, or load up with DVDs, craft books, and paperbacks for the kids for those rainy days at Fish Camp. Pick up a free ticket while they last for the June 19th Fairy Tale Story Puppet Show, performed by Stevens Marionette Puppets as they make their statewide tour this summer. Complete activities listed on the library's Reading Passport Guide for youth and adults by July 31st, and earn a reusable Build a Better World tote bag for all your library treasures throughout the year. For specific Build a Better World Summer Library Program information, please visit the library's website or call the main desk at 907-486-8686 or stop by at 612 Egan Way. If you've never been to the library, this is the summer to explore how library resources are your resources.
Thank you, Katie, for that informative clip. And there's lots to do at the Kodiak Public Library. Maybe we'll see you there. I want to tell you about one of my favorite authors, Louise Erdrich. She has been described as, quote, one of the most gifted, prolific, and challenging of contemporary Native American novelists. Louise was born in Little Falls, Minnesota, and grew up mostly in Wahpeton, North Dakota, where her parents taught at Bureau of Indian Affairs schools. Her fiction reflects the aspects of her mixed heritage, German through her father and French and Ojibwe from her mother. Her writing is beautifully lyrical and exacting, and the lives of her characters are rich. One review I read said, quote, Louise Erdrich not only tells amazing stories, she tells them with lyricism, with a beauty that is rare, rich, textured, and ecstatic. She mixes the contemporary with the historical, wisdom with foolishness, crimes with punishment, individual and communal, guilt with redemption, violence and justice, beauty with ugliness, the mundane with the magic, and tragedy with comedy. She tells of lives that weave in and out from family to family, generation to generation, which invite a deeper understanding of the human condition. Louise Erdrich has written adult novels. She has written story collections and children's literature. Some of her more well-known novels include Love Medicine, The Beet Queen, Bingo Palace, The Antelope Wife, The Last Report on the Miracles of Little No Horse, The Master Butcher Singing Club, The Painted Drum, The Plague of Doves, Shadow Tag, The Roundhouse, and her most recent novel is called La Rose. For children, she's written The Birch Bark House, The Game of Silence, The Porcupine Year, as well as she has works of poetry, of nonfiction, and has contributed to books with other authors. One of my favorite novels that I have read of hers is The Last Report on the Miracles at Little No Horse. This story reaches back to 1910 to tell the tale of Father Damien Modesty, a priest on the Little No Horse Reservation, whose parishioners include Nana Push and the Cashpaw family, and Father Damien is a woman named Agnes, who has lived as a man his whole life, and now he's 80 years old. After coming to the reservation, he fears his secret will be discovered. The story travels back and forth through time, telling of these people's lives and of the observations that Louise so well draws for us. Here's a clip from the audible version of The Last Report of the Miracles at Little No Horse, narrated by Anna Fields. We meet Agnes as she's heading to the reservation for the first time.
The arrival, 1912. Just as in a dream or under extreme duress, we make plans and decisions that panic us with their force and strangeness by the light of day. So Agnes shocked herself. The first morning that she woke on the train heading north in disguise, she reeled with her own foolhardiness and thought of leaping out of the caboose. Surely she'd die of exposure out there. And then the train stopped at a small board shack hardly bigger than an outhouse. She spent the night there, curled around the lukewarm flanks of a rusted stove. Tomorrow, she thought, I'll get rid of this cassock and be Agnes DeWitt again, formerly Sister Cecilia, who has lived enough for two women and two nuns already, let alone a mission priest. She imagined that she'd find some way of trading clothing, or if all else failed, come clean with the nearest sane person in North Dakota. But she was alone, and considering what she'd just done, probably no judge of sanity. The next morning, she waited miserably for the driver who, it said in a tattered note nailed to the wall, would transport the priest to Little No Horse. By the time the wagon arrived, Agnes was so famished with hunger that she had dipped into a sack waiting next to her and chewed some raw, dusty oats. Though in a daze of passivity, when she found herself climbing into the seat of a rough wagon drawn by winter-shagged horses and driven by a man still rougher than the whole lot, her heart clenched. And the urge again took her to bolt back into the skin of Miss DeWitt. But how could she? Perhaps once the wagon stopped, once they'd arrived, she'd seize a chance. They started out for the reservation in the wake of a killing sickness, on the eve of St. Dismas in the gain of the year. March. Onavany Gizus, it is called. Crust on the snow moon, for the angle of the sun strikes just so enough to melt and refreeze the surface while the snow lies beneath. Ever after that day, Agnes was to mark St. Dismas upon her calendar, because it was the first day of her existence as Father Damien, the first day of the great lie that was her life. The true lie, she considered it, the most sincere lie a person could ever tell. Agnes was a person of deep curiosity, and so even in extremity she couldn't help observing all around her that was new. She rode along with interest, even though her brain was half frozen, and she suffered stabs of intense cold. Ah, the priest's clothes, that was another thing. Even now the driver treated her with much more respect as a priest than she'd ever known as a nun. He was deferential, though not uncomfortable. Agnes was surprised to find that this treatment entirely gratified her, and yet seemed familiar, as though it was her due. Robes or not, I am human, she said to herself. So this is what a priest gets, heads bowing and curious, respectful attention. Back on the train, people also had given Father Damien more privacy. It was as though in priest's garments she walked within a clear bell of charged air. Cashbaugh was the driver's name. He was the first Indian she'd ever met, and he would be one of the first she'd bury come that summer and the Feast of Saints. He was dark, and in the cold his skin took on a purplish cast. Dressed as he was in a French red wool capote, with a swirl of hot yellow turban cloth, and weighted by moose-hide leggings, great mitts made of wolves' fur, velvet shawls, and another curly buffalo robe thrown on besides, he was a mountain of texture and sharp color. He spoke, of course, no German, only some English, and his French was of a vintage extremely valuable were it only wine. In addition, that 18th-century trapper's French was knocked aside or disarranged by words only to be guessed at, probably the language spoken by Ojibwe. And yet, in spite of their language problems, Agnes couldn't help questioning Cashpaw eagerly. Something new was at work, she could feel it. An ease with her own mind she'd never felt before. A pleasure in her own wit she'd half hidden or demurred. As Agnes, she'd always felt too inhibited to closely question men. Questions from women to men always raised questions of a different nature. As a man, she found that Father Damien was free to pursue all questions with frankness and ease. On the long drive north, she learned all of the polite Ojibwe she could cram into her brain. How to ask after children and spouses. How to comment on the weather. How to accept and appreciate food. These last phrases, unfortunately, would be useless until there actually was food on the reservation.
That clip from the last report on the miracles at Little No Horse gives you an idea of the rich language and the pictures that Louise Erdrich draws with her concise writing style. A quote that came from another one of her books, From the Painted Drum, was, "Life will break you. Nobody can protect you from that, and living alone won't either, for solitude will also break you with its yearning. You have to love. You have to feel. It is the reason you are here on earth. You are here to risk your heart. You are here to be swallowed up." Louise Erdrich has won several awards. Her debut novel, Love Medicine, was the National Book Critics Circle Award, and it's been featured in the National Advanced Placement for Test for Literature. She followed that with The Beat Queen, which continued her technique using several narrators to tell her story. She also was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction for her Plague of Doves, and her most recent book, which I'm currently reading, called La Rose, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction in 2016. I found La Rose at the Kodiak Public Library in hardback, and I understand that it's now come out in paperback. But La Rose Iron is a very special 8-year-old with a name that goes back for generations. The person with this name is known for kindness and wisdom beyond their years. LaRose is a great kid, and you'll love him. We see back to 1839, when the first LaRose was a girl, sold by her desperate mother for food. We follow her journey, and there are looks back into the history of several other characters, with particular focus on their experiences in BIA schools. Influenced by William Faulkner, Louise Erdrich said she wanted to write something about LaRose that in many families, historical names carry on throughout the generations. The story begins on a reservation in North Dakota with a hunting accident that changes the lives of two families forever. Landro Iron thinks he is shooting at a deer, and he accidentally shoots his nephew, Dusty. So they cope with it by Emmeline and Landro Iron giving their son to Dusty's family. Peter and Nola Ravitch grieve for their lost child, and they try to incorporate his replacement, LaRose, into their new families. There are wonderful characters in this book. Dusty's older sister, Maggie, who we meet as a teen, is particularly fierce and a moving personality compared with LaRose's older sisters, who are loving and giving. And both families are examined in great detail. There are some lines that run throughout it that you might want to keep an eye on. Losing children is a popular theme, and it highlights the importance of community ties and maintaining a wide family network. Clearness of spirit darkens the scene for this or that character from time to time. There always seems to be a struggle, a challenge of coping with being dealt a lousy hand and dealing with the hand that you are dealt. Making things right emotionally and spiritually, if not always physically, is important for Landrau as he grieves and heals from this accident. Louise Erdrich tells amazing stories, and she tells them with a lyricism and a beauty that I hope you will enjoy as well. There's a mixture of contemporary, historical wisdom and foolishness that you will find throughout this book. I'm halfway through it at the moment, so I don't have any spoilers to give you, but I suggest that you check it out. That's LaRose by Louise Erdrich, available at the Kodiak Public Library, along with many other of her titles that she has written. Another of my favorite authors is William Goldman, author of Marathon Man, Your Turn to Curtsy, My Turn to Bow, and most notably Princess Bride. Let's listen to a book review that Nia and Katie did last year about this, one of their favorite books.
Hey there, and welcome to another book talk with Katie and Nia. Today we are doing The Princess Bride by William Goldman.
Okay, Nia, this is my favorite book of all time. I know I say that about every book I read, but this one really is my favorite.
So this is a really interesting book because not only does it have a great plot and a great story and fabulous characters.
Fabulous characters! Their backstories are beautiful. Go on.
Thank you, Katie. The book is told from the perspective of a guy who read this book when he was younger and is now rereading it again. Every so often, he'll interject and say what he thinks about a character or a situation. And it says on the cover, The Princess Bride, S. Morgenstern's classic tale of true love and high adventure. Actually, S. Morgenstern didn't write the book. William Goldman is pretending like he is abridging the novel by S. Morgenstern, but really, it's not. It's his story. He made it up.
I think it's a genius setup, honestly. It had me fooled for like half the book.
Yeah, I figured it out today when Katie told me.
I love the elaboration and the backstory and the anecdotes in this novel. Like, the movie is fabulous, but it doesn't capture all these stories from these characters that come together, intertwine to make another story.
All the characters are so beautifully described in this book. You don't love all the characters. Like, some books make you love every single character they have. In this book, I actually hate one of the main characters because...
Who is this, Nia?
Okay, so first we meet Buttercup, who is a vain, spoiled, immature girl. She gets everything she wants because she is really beautiful, and it's kind of annoying because she's not really smart at all. And then she gets jealous and decides she is in love with the farm boy named Wesley, who she treated horribly until she realized that she loved him, which I'm slightly skeptical of.
I, on the other hand, think Buttercup is fabulous. I don't think she is perfect, like
Wesley.
Wesley, yes. Wesley the farm boy.
Oh, don't change the subject. I don't think she's perfect, but none of us really are. She was just playful, and I think that she is smart. I don't know where I'm going with this. She's a good character.
Well, now let's move on to Wesley. Wesley, on the other hand, is perfect in every single way.
I know, he's totally unrealistic, which makes me love him even more. I think everyone who reads this book falls in love with Wesley,
because not only is he good-looking, charming, intelligent, and great with a sword, his love for Buttercup is so genuine that he doesn't care that she's immature and selfish and vain. But Wesley, he ends up leaving in the very beginning, and you think he's gone forever. But then, later, there's a plot twist, and he returns.
We're not giving away the book!
My second favorite character to Wesley is Inigo Montoya.
Oh my goodness, same!
His father was killed when he was very young, and his life's goal is to murder the man who killed his father. And so he spends his whole life training to become the best swordsman on Earth.
Inigo Montoya squeezes rocks for 7 years just to build up his strength. Dedication, my friends, dedication! He goes to the masters for so many years. How many years did he train?
For like his whole life.
For his entire life, to kill the one man who killed his father. He is so inspiring, honestly. I mean, I probably wouldn't have that much dedication to kill one man. But then again, my mother wasn't killed. My father wasn't killed by a six-figure man.
Inigo's line in the book that has become very famous, like through the movie too, is, "My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die."
That is a line that just, boom, it impacts you. Even though it's so commonly used nowadays. Out of all the things he could say, he could like yell at him. He could scream at him for killing his father. He could torture him. But he just goes straight to the point because that's really what his life was about. Getting straight to that point.
And not necessarily getting revenge, but just avenging his father. Not taking revenge on the person like, you ruined my life because you killed my father. It's more like, you took my father's life in such a brutal manner. You deserve the same. You have it coming.
Now, my other favorite character, which I'm going to say about all of these characters, is Fezzik.
Fezzik, who is like a giant. And he's not that smart, but it's okay because he is literally such a sweetheart.
He's like, the nicest guy.
He is the epitome of gentle giant.
Honestly. And his backstory in this book, it just brought me to tears a few times.
He was always teased because he was always bigger than the other kids and stronger, and he didn't really know his strength. And then his father started teaching him self-defense so he wouldn't get picked on, and he ended up becoming like a wrestler or something, right? And so then no one likes him at the wrestling matches because he always wins, and people don't like that. And so he ends up leaving, and he meets up with Inigo and Vicini. Vicini is this kind of manipulative, intelligent, but rather cocky in the fact that he thinks he's more intelligent than everyone else.
Which takes away from his intelligence.
He's a Sicilian, and that's kind of how they refer to him in the very beginning when they kidnap Buttercup. And they just refer to him as the Sicilian, so you're kind of like, who is this guy?
Yeah. I watched the movie before I read the book.
Oh, I did too.
I recommend watching the movie before you read the book because it was casted so perfectly that when you read the book, the characters' iconic voices will be in your head and it'll make it all the more interesting. Okay, this book has something for everyone. It has humor, romance, action, evil, good, revenge, giants, sword fights, battles of wits, good guys, bad guys, lies, truths, death, life, and most importantly, true love. I did write that out beforehand. I'm actually quite proud of that.
I like this book because it has adventure, it has romance, it has sword fights, which are always fun.
They are indeed always fun. My favorite aspect of this book is the humor and the wit and charm that just flows. It's not like people trying to be funny. It's just like the characters, they know what they're doing. They know that it's funny. That brings me to another point, Nia. Each character has one or two defining qualities, which makes the book so interesting because each one's so different.
Buttercup, the only thing she has is her beauty, honestly.
Peanut gallery over there.
No, seriously. Wesley, he's smart, he's dedicated, he's funny. Inigo is an inspiration.
Courageous.
Courageous. Fezzik is sweet, even though he's strong. He doesn't use his strength to his advantage or taking advantage of other people.
I actually see what you're getting at. Even the Sicilian, he is smart and he's determined. But Buttercup just...
she's just there.
I still like her a lot, though, because I feel like I can identify with her a little bit.
Katie, you're smarter than Buttercup.
Oh, thank you. In the end, she becomes the exact same person.
She doesn't really change. Like, other characters develop. Like, Fezzik, he decides that he can be smart. Because I think he was kind of just convinced that he couldn't be smart. And he was all brawn and no brains.
Mm-hmm.
And Inigo has finally completed his life school. And so he can now rest in peace and be happy. Wesley is finally with his true love. And he is so happy. Buttercup's just like, well, I always get what I want. There's nothing different. You're gonna have to go and get a copy at the library. Anyways, thank you so much for listening. We had a great time talking about this book. I hope you go out and I hope you read it.
And I hope you form your own opinions on characters such as Buttercup.
Thanks, girls, for that fun interview. Well, thanks for listening this month. We'll hope to see you next month on Dog-Eared Reads. Simple little book.